Welcome to the CRE Exchange podcast, where we deep dive into the global trends and challenges of professionals across all sectors of the commercial real estate industry. We engage with experts in this space to bring you innovative insights into industry practices, opportunities, and challenges to better inform your decisions. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a leading provider of CRE intelligence. We connect data, analytics, applications, and expertise to power CRE performance.
Welcome everyone to another exciting episode of the CRE Exchange. I'm Cole Perry, your host and Associate Director of Research at Altus Group, a leading provider of commercial real estate intelligence. I'm here with Omar Altaray, our Senior Director of Research, to provide you with the latest news and trends in the commercial real estate market. We're excited to have on a special guest with us today, Jay Parsons. Jay is a rental housing economist, former chief economist at RealPage, an economic advisor to JPI, strategy advisor to Modera Residential. Jay also partners with Waymaker and advises developers, investors, and policymakers on multifamily and rental housing trends. Jay, thank you so much for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I gave a little bit of it, but if you don't mind for our listeners, how would you walk us through in your own words a little about your background and why we've got you here today?
Yeah, some of you probably heard the story, but I, like a lot of people in multifamily and single family rentals, I stumbled into the industry entirely by accident or divine intervention, whichever term you want to prefer. It was 2009 and I was unemployed and needing a job and newly engaged, which is a bad combination. And so it took a really, honestly, a kind of a crummy job as a research analyst, writing very dry reports on the apartment market for a group called MPF Research. It was part of RealPage at that point. So didn't have intent of sticking around very long, but fell in love with the space, the myth-busting element of it. I think what I love about rental housing is it's one of these categories I think all of us think we intuitively understand because we've lived in a rental, I have somebody else who did. But it's actually a lot more nuanced than I think people give it credit for, whether it's an investor, a policymaker, a reporter, or whoever. So I love that aspect of it. And so I fell in love with the industry and the space, and just in the last year and a half or so, I've been independent, or almost a couple of years now, and working with different groups and different strategies across the country, and love what I do.
So tell us a little more. I think back then when you were mostly focused on specific data analysis, now you're doing a wider range of things in the industry. How do you think your vantage points changed over time?
Oh, that's a good question. So when you start off as an analyst, or probably the same thing, whether you're a research analyst or investment analyst or whatever your role is, you just try to understand all the unique dynamics of each individual market. And I think that the more time you're in a bit, probably this is probably true of any industry, but I think the more time I spent in rental housing, the more you realize how much themes impact all these markets across the country. So I think my focus has really shifted from, okay, I want to learn something new every day, but now it's more like putting these pieces together. Just rather than just gathering pieces, like it starts to shift to, you try to put these pieces together and see what it all means. My first job and my first assignment was to write a report on the fourth quarter 2008 Chicago apartment market. And it's very kind of micro, here's what's going on, here's the job numbers, here's the occupancy numbers. And now it's more focused on, okay, what are the themes facing the industry? What are the challenges? How is it unique in Chicago versus Boston versus Dallas? What are the common threads? But then also, I spend a lot more time now as well on the strategy side of where he'll want to build or buy. Also the policy side, even advising some cases, different regulatory bodies of different types, or working with investors who are trying to navigate increasingly challenging regulatory environments. And so it's changed a lot, but it's, like I said, I enjoy that type of stuff.
You've got institutional investors, REITs, developers, lenders, and particularly multifamily, a lot of public sector groups. And this as a yes or no question, but I assume you have a little more to it. Does that kind of shape how you think about multifamily, say, differently than someone who only looks at it from a policy perspective?
Oh, yeah. I think that I wish that every housing analyst or policy person would spend time in the industry, because I think what they would do is they would realize that there's a bad apple in every industry, I'm sure, but the vast majority of the industry wants to be part of the solution. And I think that when you're purely on the outside and you're doing policy and advocacy work, because I'm sure it's very easy to take a very cynical view of the industry. If you're just the type of person who throws around terms like private equity and investment groups and Wall Street, then you're not part of the solution. You're just a rabble rouser. And I think what ultimately people benefit from, and one thing I've really learned over the years, is that when we focus on working together towards solutions as opposed to just demonizing one side or the other, when we work together, we're far more likely to get to actual solutions.
Now, Jay, you've been one of the most prolific voices and writers in the multifamily space. And what selfishly would love to hear your views. And I think our listeners also want to hear your views. So we'll start at the high level and break it down, supply and demand, and then get into some pricing. First, on the supply side, we've seen new starts really slowing after a pretty massive boom. Do you expect supply shortages to emerge or really become more pronounced in 26, 27?
Absolutely. I think if you're somebody who just follows multifamily and single family from the outside, and you get these, like this ping pong ball of headlines, it says, oh, we're undersupplied by 7 million homes. And the other side is, hey, we're oversupplied and therefore prices are falling. And I don't think, and people, it's like, what's true, right? And I hate the word oversupply because I think it's the wrong word. What's happening right now, particularly in the multifamily space, is we built a ton of supply that dumped all around the same time. And even though there's demand for it, people forget. It's not that there's like people are just waiting outside for a building to open and then they could finally have a bed. Like, people have temporary living arrangements, whether it's with family, friends, maybe it's in another lease they don't expect to be in very long. And so you don't just unlock that much demand instantaneously. It does take time to absorb. So that doesn't mean we have too much housing. It just sometimes means there's a temporary supply-demand imbalance. So you're right. I think what's happening right now is that, unfortunately, it's very hard to time supply with demand, right? Supply is always responding to demand. When there's a lot of demand in 21, we built a lot of housing, but didn't deliver for 2+ years after that. And by that point, now there's more supply than demand in the short term. And so it's cyclical. And unfortunately, it'll continue to be cyclical. So I think if the economy is even halfway decent shape, then some markets a year from now, and certainly 2 and 3 years from now, we'll be talking about undersupply again. And so that's just the reality of a business where you can't instantaneously satisfy demand. Like, it takes time to get products planned, funded, approved, and built.
And it's a market, right? Like, markets are always, supply and demand is always shifting. But are there any markets that are on your radar that you see the biggest mismatch between supply and demand?
Yeah, I think that the obvious ones have been, certain coastal and Midwest markets that just haven't delivered much in recent decades. And so in some cities, you have more properties that are kind of aging into obsolescence than you have being newly delivered. And so we've still seen solid rent growth in much of the Midwest and the coastal, and some of the coastal markets. Obviously, San Francisco is a prime example of this. San Francisco is the ultimate boom bust market, right? And it went through a terrible bust with the pandemic, and it was much more hard hit than most of the U.S. for various reasons. And so naturally, there's a complete shutdown of supply for 5+ years. And even prior to that, they weren't building much to begin with anyway. And so when the demand finally did come back, with the tech companies bringing people back into the office and the city kind of doing a lot to improve the quality of life, a bunch of us were just out there for ULI's fall meeting. And the city's come a long way, and you can see the life come back to it, but there's no supply. And so San Francisco leads the nation in rent growth right now. So that's probably the most extreme example, but I think it's generally true across much of these more mature cities.
And hopping over to the demand side, many kind of demographic trends have been picked up and highlighted by whether it's research teams or by the media, including like the millennial preference for renting. You have downsizing of boomers or staying in place boomers. Are any of these, or I guess, which of these themes do you think are durable and are going to be lasting for years? And which of these do you think are probably just shorter term trends that might fade away?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I'll tell you a funny story. So one of the first conferences I went to for multifamily, I started the industry, there was a conversation about millennial renters. And at this point, millennials were in their 20s, the oldest millennials in their 20s, and some of the millennials were still in their teens. And there was a kind of a boomer-aged research analyst, a researcher in a role like mine, who made a comment that millennials would rather drink battery acid than live in the suburbs. And I remember thinking to myself, it's like, and I'm what I'd call a geriatric millennial. I'm on the old end of millennials. And I remember thinking to myself, I don't think that's true. And sure enough, it wasn't true, of course. So I think one thing in research, it's always important to kind of separate these axioms versus the nuance that is really there. And so we could probably dive into a lot of different things on this topic, but I think sometimes we tend to make too much of what really are niche opportunities in terms of demand. And so I'll give you another example. There was a lot of fuss for a while about like micro units, and it was much more fuss than reality. I think you always be careful about those. And even things for like demand around like senior housing, like there's a lot of views that because of the demographics of the aging population, that there's gonna be a ton of demand for senior housing. But it turns out that with technology and in-place home care, people are preferring to age in place where they can, or if they're downsizing to an apartment, a lot of them would rather live not with a bunch of old people. If they're upwardly mobile still, they want to live in a vibrant area with the mixed generations. So there's certainly been niche opportunities for senior housing, and some groups do very well at it, but it hasn't been quite the demand boom that I think some people thought. And there's probably a ton more examples like that, but I'll give you one more too, is I think another thing that's been a kind of a mismatch that's evolving now around the kind of supply demand story is that in the last cycle, there's a big shift towards smaller units and building more one bedrooms. And now we're starting to see, there's been a couple of good research studies showing that the preference is shifting back to more two and maybe even three bedroom units, which three bedroom has almost been like a bad word in apartments for the last 10 years. And so I think there's some good stories there.
I could see that playing out where it's the three bedroom, maybe it's a smaller, there's probably overall less demand, but I wouldn't be shocked if you have longer leases, yeah. Right? And so you have better retention there because that's probably a family that's moving in. But we've seen some pretty big moves in terms of the cost pressures that owners have to deal with. I think there's been broad-based inflation, but particularly in multifamily, you've seen higher insurance costs, just your employee and kind of labor and property management costs have moved up, as well as taxes have also moved up. Which of these have you been like most focused on, or do you see as being the most challenging for owners and operators?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think first and foremost, the cost pressures have mitigated. What's interesting is like, I think in this cycle, the revenues took off early in 21, 22. And then of course, inflation caught up on the other side of things. And so then revenues cooled off the last 2+ years, but expense growth continued to spike for another 2 years after that. And then it really wasn't until these last 12 months, I think we've started to see some real expense relief. It is a real adjustment. I mean, obviously, I'll give you a great example is I'm sure something that you all are well aware of is when you look at what's going on with insurance, you know, you have a lot of groups that saw, especially in the places like Florida, you know, they saw double digit increases in their per unit insurance costs, insurance premiums at the peak. And so in a lot of cases, they're actually seeing cuts in their insurance premiums for this last round of renewals. However, even with a cut, like their costs are still substantially higher in the past. And property taxes are similar. You had this big period where property tax is the biggest expense for most apartment owners. And those property tax rates were going up. It's always funny too, is everybody always wants to talk about rent growth. Nobody ever talks about the property taxes. And those taxes are going up a lot too. And that's the biggest expense. And while it's moderated, the pace of growth is moderated to back into the low mid single digits. Like you don't go backwards, but your rents can go backwards, but rarely do your property taxes go backwards. And so, you know, that's a sticky cost. And so I think the main thing is it's become more predictable again, but it's just the structural cost of operating an apartment is certainly higher than it was 5 years ago.
So jumping back a little bit to some of the demand side, you've already talked about some of the demographic trends driving a lot of this, but what are some of the indicators you watch super closely? Is that migration, job growth? Is it the affordability gap? What are we talking about there?
Yeah, so I think it's a mix of things, honestly. There's no silver bullet that I look at. You know, people ask me that question a lot. And the reality is, I think sometimes it's looking for the signal amidst the noise. I mean, you guys know that there's so much data out there right now. That what I really look for is patterns of, hey, like I like to see other multiple indicators that something's really happening. And because we could all cherry pick a random data source to get a headline and some clicks on, and we see a lot of that. But so I look at things like, you look at the absorption numbers, demand, you look at migration, but migration data tends to be kind of lagging. So absorption tends to be a more real-time indicator of apartment demand and renter household demand. I look at other things that are more like leasing metrics. So you look at things like days vacant between leases, retention rates, and then you obviously occupancy is part of that. But also the concession data as well. Is that ramping up, ramping down? That could be an indicator of how confident the operators are in that market. So yeah, it's a combination of things from different data providers as well. But I like to dig through all of it and see what jumps out.
I know Omar and I have a few more questions about that later in our list here for you, but excited to dive into those. Something we haven't talked about yet that I think underlies all of this is is interest rates, capital markets, financing. If you were to tell the story of the last couple of years, how have elevated rates shaped and how are they shaping multifamily deal flow and underwriting up to now?
Yeah, well, obviously it's been a challenge. So you think about like apartments relative to, you know, say office, like the difference, while apartment values have been impacted by higher rates, we've not seen the distress volumes that a lot of people expected to see. And the reason for that is that even distressed owners and would-be sellers and actual sellers are still very, unlike an office, or especially office has obviously gotten a little better, but compared to what it was a few years ago, the sellers are still bullish on multifamily. And so nobody's really looking just to get out, right? Unless it's a really bad, just a unique situation they need to get out of. It's more deal specific than it is sector specific. So I think that has really slowed things down in the sense that properties are worth more because properties are valued based on NOI and your costs are up because the cost of debt is up, your mortgage payments are up. So therefore your property is worth less because you have higher cost. But that kind of on paper valuation you don't have a lot of sellers that are willing to transact at those numbers. They're willing to recap or find ways to hold on and wait out better days. And I think most of the industry and even most of the broader investment community expects that. And so I think that's the real consequence has been just this much more kind of slowed environment. And it's also weeded out short-term buyers where it's, you know, all this kind of short-term syndication groups that were, you know, buy and flip type strategies, 1, 2, 3 year holds. They're pretty much out of the market. Like that's a tough strategy right now. And so the bigger implication has been like those who are still active in the market are generally going to be longer term holders with 5 to 10 year hold periods because they're able to take on what's probably going to be a relatively soft year 1 and 2 expectations in anticipation of much stronger years and years 2, 3, 4, et cetera.
So in terms of that debt side, what are you seeing in terms of refinancing risk or maybe just changes in lender behavior?
Lenders have been very patient as well for the most part. And I think that's been another kind of thing. It's like, the whole extend and pretend thing has got a lot of waves, but there's not a lot of, I'm maybe just too optimistic, but it's not a lot of pretend. It's really just extend. And I think it's in the best interest of the lenders. Every deal is different, obviously. I can't say there's not exceptions to this, but generally speaking, I think lenders often find it's in their best interest to be patient as well. And, maintain that relationship, especially if it's been a good sponsor for a long period of time, and also not have to worry about the operational risk of foreclosing on an asset and figuring out what to do with it. And so I think that that's been the other part of this, too, is that there's been much more kind of willingness to work with borrowers, particularly on good quality deals and good locations. Now, I do think it's to get messier in certain subtypes. The clock's going to run out. If you bought an older vintage, heavy value add deal at the peak with floating rate debt, the path to recovery on that deal might be a long ways off. And so at some point, there's got to be a reckoning on some of those deals. But and that stuff's going to make a lot of noise. That stuff's going to make headlines. But it's a relatively small piece of the pool. In fact, Newmark has a really good chart they do every quarter in their book. And what it shows is they're estimating something like 80, I'm making up a number here, but it's like 80 something billion dollars of potential multifamily distress. And a lot of it's that kind of profile. And it's such a big number, like $80 billion. It's a $2.3 trillion debt market in the US. We're talking about 3%. So it's not fake news, like it's real, but we're also talking about a relatively small piece of the pie where that noise is going to come from.
So I think you've given us a good overview of some of your thoughts on kind of the macro environment. And I guess when you're looking towards the future for multifamily demand or maybe just valuations for multifamily, is there any particular macro development you think could change your view? Is there anything that would really shift that?
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously, if there's a much bigger shift in rates than it's expected, that's going to play a role. If there's a real recession that's prolonged, that can have an impact. I certainly hope that's not the case. But the big thing that everybody's waiting for on the more positive side is getting renewed rent growth. Because a part of this is that even if you don't have to see low rates for rallies to come back, obviously. I think some kind of cynics think they just look at, oh, these year one spreads are so low and therefore it's a bad investment. It's like, no, they're not assuming this big reduction in rates. What they're really assuming is that after 2+ years of no rent growth, that we finally start to see rent growth and revenue growth reemerge and the NOI story improves. So that's the real X factor everybody's waiting for, is when does that happen?
So let's shift the conversation slightly and dive in specifically to affordability and the GSEs, because I know that is a big piece of the broader pie, depending if it's capital A or lowercase a affordable. But affordability, or lack of, has really been kind of an area of focus and hot topic amongst housing economists like yourself and just the broader industry, it seems like, for many decades. But one thing that does seem to be changing recently has been it's going a bit more mainstream and is getting talked about outside of economic journals. What do you think that is?
Well, okay, so yeah, I mentioned earlier, I love the myth-busting stuff and the nuance that I didn't fully appreciate until I dove into the space. And one of my passion points is, like, rental affordability especially is such a misunderstood topic. It's far more nuanced than anybody gives it credit for. And especially, obviously, in the public, but even in the industry, it's much more nuanced than we tend to give it credit for. I have a lot of respect for my friends that are macro housing analysts, but I will tell you, it's the for-sale housing market and the rental housing market operate very differently. They're very different things. And a lot of times I'll see my friends on the for-sale housing side make statements about rental affordability using just broad brush data that it's true, but it's also misleading. And I'll give you a great example of this. It's like one of the stats that everybody is sort of ingrained in everybody's minds is this stat that from the census data showing that the typical renter is spending 31% of income on rent. More than half of Americans are rent burdened. That's a true stat, but it's also a very misleading one, because what people take from that is, okay, well, affordability is a problem. They can't afford rent increases. Everyone's rent cost burdened. When you look deeper into that data, you see a real split. And what it shows is that when you have households that are making more than $50,000, and this isn't Jay Parsons data, it's not industry data, this is census data, the same data everybody points to, but doesn't really look deeply enough into. If you have a household more than $50,000, and by the way, they include roommates, we have a lot of apartments, obviously, you have 2 25-year-olds out of school that are collectively a six-figure income household. So anybody, if a household $50,000, they spend 22% of income on rent. And that aligns with all the publicly traded REITs report, that aligns with what RealPage data shows for new lease signers signing leases, 22% of income spent on rent. And that's a good number. That's healthy for everybody, right? The real challenge is those below $50,000. And in particular, 22% of multifamily renters make less than $20,000, which is really tough. I mean, there's no realistic level of rent they can afford that under 20-30% of their income and be able to cover the operating costs of that property. So that's the problem. And so when I talk about affordability, I think people get caught up on this. And I'll say, I think for the market rate sector, freshly managed, affordability is more of a tailwind than a headwind. But that's not to say affordability is not a problem. And so I think there's a lot of misdirected angst on this topic, and we really need a better job focusing where the challenges really exist.
Sticking on the topic, was there ever a golden era of affordability? Or every time that I've read one of these reports, it's always been an issue. And
yeah,
it
yeah.
seems as though it's never, there was never a point when it wasn't an issue. If you think back through history, was there a point when we actually had a balanced, like, affordable market?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I'll tell you two quick, stories here. Number one is that when you look at that same census data, it's like the narrative is, rents are growing faster than incomes. No, that's actually not been true. For actual renters, their rent income ratios have been around 29-31% for as far back as the census data goes, at least going back prior to the GFC, the for data that I've seen. It hasn't really moved. And then the ratio. And the other thing, going back further, I'm actually reading a book right now. It's called The Rent Wars in New York City. It's about the early 1900s. It's a fascinating book that talks about what led to the first versions of rent control being passed in New York City. And a lot of it's housing shortage related. And that drove up some of the cost challenges, as well as a bunch of other factors. And so it was a good reminder. It's like everybody kind of romanticizes like the good old days, but housing affordability, forget rentals, like housing affordability has been a problem as long as there's been housing. This is not a new phenomenon. It didn't start when Wall Street invested housing, like contrary to all the conspiracy theories out there. This has been an issue for a very long time.
And while you're in myth-busting mode, BTR, SFR, or more permissioning for ADUs, have those or could those move the needle in terms of the affordability picture, even if the affordability picture is skewed as is?
Look, I think everything helps, right? Like I'm an option E, all of the above guy. And so like ADUs on their own, like if like people in California who think ADUs are the pathway to affordability, I would tell them, I'm not against what you're doing, but you need a lot more things to jump in on as well, because that's not enough. You need to ultimately find ways to build more housing of all types. We need so-called luxury apartments. We need smaller multifamily. We need a true affordable LIHTC housing. We need more single-family homes, more for sale and for rent. But also, I mean, just, you know, in terms of pure efficiency, it's like everybody likes to romanticize smaller, more single-family homes. We need more townhomes. I like all those things. ADUs, what moves the needle fastest is building large multifamily buildings. And so I'm not against, I want to do it all, but I also don't want people to lose sight of the fact that when you can build 300, 400 units, you're building at a lower cost per unit and you're solving housing for a lot of people a lot faster. And so my answer is always, you need all of the above. Don't lose sight of any of them.
Fantastic. And in the GSEs or Fannie and Freddie have played and continue to play a massive role in the housing market. Do you think their role or their impact would change if they were to exit conservatorship?
So I have a hard time seeing a scenario where they change that dramatically. Like I think there's so much focus, understandably so, around the future of Fannie and Freddie that they're going to have to put in guardrails that do not dramatically change the liquidity of the market, the ability to get a mortgage for a home buyer, the ability to maintain a liquid multifamily market is important as well. And I could be wrong, but I tend to be pretty optimistic about that. One of the missions of the GSEs is to provide a liquid market. And so I actually think they can do a better job of that as a privately held company. And the reason I say that is that when you're held by the federal government, you're beholden to the whims of politics and who's elected into office. And that creates uncertainty in the market, and uncertainty is a killer of liquidity. And so, for example, you know, when in 2020, all of a sudden properties that had Fannie and Freddie debt were subject to an eviction moratoria, that wasn't part of the original deal. And that, by the way, that's not good or bad from a policy standpoint. I think it obviously started off okay, but then took too far. But then in the next administration, it was taken to, okay, we're going to propose installing rent control through any property that wants Fannie or Freddie debt. Okay, for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. Now you're going to make that market a lot less liquid because you're constraining revenue potential while not constraining expense. And so that what makes the market less liquid and less likely for Fannie and Freddie to uphold their original mandates and their missions. And so I do think that being out of that political arena will allow the market, particularly in multifamily, to remain more liquid.
I'm going to put you on the hot seat here for a second, but what do you think the chances are that the GSEs will leave conservatorship in the next 12 months?
Well, I mean, obviously, I don't know, but I mean, if I had to pick, I would have told you a year ago, I would have said very low. Now I would say if I had to pick one, I'll probably say yes. I think we all correlate. All of us have things we have strong convictions about, and others you have soft convictions. I'd put this in the soft bucket. But I think there's a good chance it happens. I'm obviously talking about the first administration, first time Trump was in office. And this time around, they seem to be much more serious about it. And the conversations, I read the same stuff y'all do, but it seems to be much more advanced than I would have expected.
So, Jay, in order to understand this space, you have to be a voracious consumer of data. And I know that one of the things that Omar and I have really enjoyed seeing you talk about is the differences between the public data and the private data. You've already cited some census numbers. But when you look at some of this public data, and I'll admit, I know that you think that some of this has degraded over time, how reliable do you find it compared to some of these private sources?
Well, I mean, at a high level, I think private sources have gotten better over the last couple of decades. I think public data has gotten worse. And I don't think that's even a controversial statement. I think anybody who deals with these data sets would probably agree with that. But that's not to say they're entirely dismissed these things. I think that when you look at government data, I think it's still directionally useful. I think one thing that drives me nuts is I think they put way too much emphasis on any month's numbers. Like, you know, when like job numbers come out and everybody's making fun of job numbers, obviously lately, it's been a hot topic. Everybody, like markets move based on the numbers and they get revised. And by the way, those revisions have been going on forever. And like, and all these debates about like jobs data, I find myself sort of in the middle. It's like, hey guys, like, yeah, sure, this has always been an issue, but that doesn't make it okay. Like, I don't think it's a political thing. I think it's just like, we got to find modern ways to collect data better than we have been, right? And we're not doing a good job of that. And I wish we'd invest. And this has been a problem across both Republican and Democratic administrations. Like, we need to find, I think, invest heavier into having good quality data. You know, in our industry, the one that's particularly bad is, and I've written, I'm sure you guys have seen it, I mean, I've written a lot about this, is the starts data. It's terrible. Every month, like, people get their Bloomberg terminal things and they see
the 20 down 20.
Yeah. And they send it to me and say, hey, Jay, you see these numbers? They're up. Biggest number in, you know, X number of years or whatever. I'm like, no, it's not. It's not true. I could get into the reasons for that. And there's methodology reasons for it. But in that regard, especially, I mean, jobs data is tougher because ADP only covers certain things. But like, when it comes to starts, the private sector data providers are night and day better than the census.
These obviously diverge often, the private and the public. How do you typically interpret those conflicting signals? Is there any kind of ground truthing you do to help with that interpretation?
Yeah, again, I think a lot of times just understanding the data sets and also cross-referencing with other materials. Like one of the worst introductions of government data ever was the Census Household Pulse Survey during the COVID period, when they had this really bad data that was showing that there's this mass distress among renters that just didn't exist. And it led to these really ridiculous stories about how like 20 million renters are at risk of eviction and things like that were never true, but they were perceived to be true because people didn't bother to look to more established data sources. And what also I found funny about that is even the census themselves didn't really believe their own data to a full extent. Because if anybody ever dove into those Excel files, those actual CSV files, there's big disclaimers saying, hey, this is an experimental data set. Like, we don't even have a basis for our sample to know if it's representative or not. And it was junk. I think that stuff is, you just have to know, sometimes you just have to ignore. Like, there's some stuff that's just bad. You just apply a sniff test. If it doesn't pass a sniff test, then probably don't over-rely on it. But there's other stuff. I mean, again, I think directionally it's still, you know, there's certain things that are better than others. And obviously, like, the ACS stuff is much, much stronger than what they do from the Household Pulse Survey.
So I guess digging into the methodological differences a little bit, what are some of the reasons that public data you think has degraded or shows such wide swings? And do they perhaps under or overcount something that you would prefer that they show?
Yeah, absolutely. I'll speak to just in the rental housing world. I mean, I'm not as, and there are better people to talk about this from like a labor standpoint because everybody's focused on the jobs data for good reason. But like, I'll tell you a couple examples. The common theme is we've not modernized the data collection methodologies in decades. These are still what I would call 1980s strategies for the digital era. And so like starts is a good example of this. Like when they first started doing this, it was probably just fine. But now there's much better, more efficient ways to collect the data. And so what the census is doing is they're calling a small percentage of people holding a building permit and saying, hey, did you start? And when you have an era now where you have multiple data providers who are trying to track every single project from plan to start to completion, you probably should be tapping into better data sets and finding a way to do that. Like, it already exists. Just use that data. And then if you think that there's holes in it for different types of product or whatever, then make some assumptions about what's missing. That'd be perfectly reasonable. But so that's an example. Another one that's gotten a lot more attention in recent years is how the BLS, Bureau of Labor Statistics, is tracking rent inflation. And at this point, everybody knows that, you know, housing inflation is almost a third of the consumer price index. And that methodology was built in the early 80s. And a lot of people don't fully understand the story. The whole, and I could go way down the rabbit trail on this one, but back in the 70s, when we last had high inflation, that was a period in which home prices were still part of the CPI. And so they changed it in the early 80s because it was too volatile, home prices, and they had some various reasons for it. And they came up with this concept called owner's equivalent rent. And there's a lot of myths about owner's equivalent rent, but it's really a survey. There is a survey of homeowners asking, what would you charge for your property if you rented it out? That's actually not used in CPI. It's a weighting metric. It's the whole other thing. It's misunderstood. But that whole concept of owner's equivalent rent, it's really a survey of renters, 7,000 renters a month. The same survey to dictate rental costs is also used to estimate homeowner costs. Well, that has nothing to do with actual homeowner costs. Like, nothing. It's just a number that's designed to be more static and steady and representative of some type, some way to say, hey, we're representing housing costs. But when 2/3 of your households are homeowners and you're using a metric that has nothing to do with their costs, and number two, you're not even surveying the people who are paying those costs, you're going to get bad data from it. And there's a whole lot of other issues as well in terms of like how we weight new leases versus renewal leases, things like that. And we only survey the same renters twice a year. So if your rent changed tomorrow, but you're surveyed today, you're not capturing that for 6 months from now. So there's a lot of other issues with it. And again, it's just, there's better ways to do it. Like we have daily rent data now. Just tap into better sources. I think that's the lack of modernization in data collection, I think, is a real problem in the public sector.
Those are the sources you don't always trust. What are the ones that you do?
In my world, multifamily, I think that the big data providers do a much better job, whether people have their favorites, whether it's CoStar, RealPage, Yardi, they all track the part mark in different ways. You got groups like Yalls, and we have MSCI Real Capital Analytics. There's a lot of, I think, large data providers that do a much better job tracking, and other sectors as well, like tracking. I like to favor data sources that are specialized in their space. Like they know the markets and they're incentivized to find better ways to track the data.
So I think as we shift towards more granular alternative or private data sources, this is good in that it's creating a lot of transparency, but I think some suggest it's creating some issues as well. Either there's selection bias or there's privacy concerns. What do you make of all that?
Yeah, but I think those are all issues you overcome. I mean, I think with just basic aggregation rules, I don't think that's something that should stop us. You know, I think in the rental market, everybody's got their own data set, but some are better than others. I think that's created a problem as well, which I won't name names, but there's one particular listing website. They have an excellent PR team. They have a terrible research team and terrible data. And so they're always out there and getting headlines, and the data is total junk that doesn't align with what anybody else is reporting, but they just doesn't stop them from pushing out for the free marketing. And there is some of that too in this era of lots and lots of everybody's got data. You do have to be choosing which ones you rely on and which ones you don't.
You've done an excellent job of pointing out some of the myths or the misconceptions, but then also you regularly do that on LinkedIn and through your channels and your podcast. In your view, is there a major misunderstanding amongst journalists, policymakers, or just the broad public that you really either spend time correcting or think is just fundamentally misunderstood and would better everybody's understanding as a whole if they got that one element right?
Absolutely. I think there's two things. Number one, we just talked about affordability. I mean, I used the term earlier, misdirected angst. You know, what kind of irritates me about this topic is that everyone's kind of wants to go after the big names, but what happens when you just want to chase the big names, you're really actually ignoring the people who need the help. Like the people who are most challenged economically and struggling to find a place to live, they don't live in apartments that are owned by Wall Street landlords. They're living in places that may not even be, that are substandard rentals, that may not even be, you know, what we call like in New York, they call like basement apartments, they're not even officially listed. There's a shadow market rental pool, and there's just a lack of good quality housing. So I think if we did a better job of focusing where the problems actually are and not trying to chase boogeymen, I think we would be more productive in finding actual solutions for those who actually need them. Like, I'm unfortunately dumb enough to have to be involved on X and post there. And there's people in there, like they're far more motivated to demonize developers and landlords than they are to actually help renters who need help. And I find that to be just completely baffling. Like, I saw a thread the other day is joking about, not even like, totally serious. There's people out there who'd rather spend that like $1 million per unit for government provided affordable housing than spend $300,000 per unit on privately run subsidies for a privately run affordable housing unit with low rent guarantees. So it doesn't make sense. And the second thing I would say is that the other side, maybe even worse, is the single family rental market. Like, and this is an interesting one because we've now seen this populist movement both from the left and the right that sort of rallied against the idea of investors owning single family homes, which is always how they spin it. It's not single family rentals, it's investors buying single family homes. And if you think about it in terms of who owns it instead of about who lives in it, again, you're sort of missing the main point, which is people need housing. And the irony to me is, like, I tell people this all the time. It's like, if you think about what single-family rentals do, it actually accomplishes policy goals, both the left and the right. Like if you're a conservative free market person, you know, when you say, hey, if you're trying to intervene in the free market, that's a violation of your core beliefs by saying that investors shouldn't be able to buy a house. So that's a whole ball of wax. If you start that doing housing, you're going to welcome it in a lot of other industries too. Then you're going to be like, oh, wait. And then on the other side, if you're progressive, and if you really want to help people progress in this world and have better access to housing and be able to access school districts for their kids they wouldn't otherwise be able to afford to access, the single-family homes are a great vehicle to do that. And there's actually great academic research, not from me or from industry groups, but actual academic research that shows that the availability of single-family rentals can help advance households that otherwise would be left to live in areas with lesser quality schools and less safe neighborhoods. And so the idea of bringing parity and increased diversity into neighborhoods and bringing people who previously would not have been able to afford to otherwise live there, that's a major goal for, I think, any honest progressive. And so we should embrace vehicles like that actually help us do that. And so that's another, I think, huge myth where the data and the research really don't align with the perceptions.
Are there any other segments of single family homes? But it sounds like there has been a good amount of research there. Are there any other segments of the housing market that you think really do need more, whether it's more data or just more focus to sharpen the understanding or opportunity?
So the real hole in data is in the sub-institutional world. You know, if you're advertising on Zillow and apartments.com, like those are all generally what I would call either it's institutional or sort of near institutional type quality housing. It's generally middle and upper part of the market for the most part. There's always exceptions, but for the most part, that's where the skew is going to be. Now, the stuff for like your individuals who own a small multifamily building and own five or six houses they rent out, like they're much less likely to put their properties online. No, they're maybe putting a sign in their yard, right? There's no on-site leasing office. There's nobody answering a call on the property management office waiting for you to call them. That is a much more difficult space to track. My perception is that based on looking at what I know about the institutional market, what I see in the overall census data, there's this gap here. So my assumption is that the lower part of that market, that shadow market, is what's pulling down the census data, but there's not a lot of great data specific to that market. So I'd love to see better data there. And then more specifically too, there's not a lot of great data on manufactured housing and mobile home communities. Like that's a source of naturally occurring affordable housing. And that's another area where I think we really need to get better. It'd be ideal to have better visibility there, both from an investment perspective as well as a development and policy perspective.
All right. And we have one final question, which we like to ask all of our guests. Jay, if you could snap your fingers and have any change to the industry come true, what would that be?
Oh, gosh, that's a great question. If I could snap my fingers and change anything, it would be that I wish that the housing world, that our housing advocates and policymakers would lock arms with housing providers and developers on common solutions. There's a lot of different ideas and things we should do, but the one thing that everybody agrees with, whether you're an affordable housing advocate, tenant rights advocate, whether you're a Democrat or Republican, the one thing everybody agrees on for the most part is that we need more housing. You know, the industry groups, the trade groups, the developers, like everybody agrees on that one thing. And so if I could change one thing, I wish that we would all just lock arms on what we actually agree on and march toward a common solution, because we spend too much time arguing about things that we disagree on and not enough time focusing on the one big thing that we all agree on, which happens to be backed by all the research and the academic studies as well.
Jay, thank you so much. I think that's all the time we've got. Appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It's been fun.
And a big thank you to our listeners for tuning in. Take care until the next episode of CRE Exchange.
Thank you for listening to the CRE Exchange podcast. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a leading provider of CRE intelligence. We connect data, analytics, applications, and expertise to power CRE performance. We are guided by bold thinking, integrity, and inclusivity, partnering with CRE professionals to maximize opportunities with exceptional service experience. Find out more at altusgroup.com.